It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in an attitude of prayer. Let us seek our fullest humanity. We may be, as some have said, about one-third beast, one-third human, and one-third divine. But none of the three parts is whole enough or wise enough to guide us. Let us try to become integrated in every way, all our parts, all our people, are the necessary elements of our fullest humanity and our most complex strength. The excellence we seek is a fragile, transient, and beautiful thing. We seek the ability to live our passing lives alive with awareness and compassion, excited by the human-scale joys that come from participating in the passing but precious splendor of people who have come alive to the challenges of life and the joys of living them. As Howard Thurman once said, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come most fully alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. Amen. One of the great ironies of religion is that no matter what our religion is, we go to our faith traditions to seek what we feel are the most profound truths of life. People in every religion would say this, that the kinds of truths they found in the religion are the most true and the most enduring. And yet, what we do is mostly just tell stories in all religions. The stories structure our lives, give us our identities, tell us that there are or are not gods, what we should or should not even care about the gods that are or are not there, and how we must live. And yet at bottom, they're stories. If we change our stories, we change our life. That's what a conversion experience is about, changing your center to live out of a new story. In Western religion, we're trained to explore and interpret stories from the Bible for their insights into reality and ethics and God's will and ways and so forth. In Hindu countries, they don't use the Bible. They use stories from their Mahabharata or the Ramayana or the philosophical writings of the Upanishads and so on. More stories. Like the Hindus, the ancient Greeks use lots of gods, while the Buddhists use stories without any gods at all. But if you want to find the bedrock for the certainties of the people and faiths, it's not facts, it's stories. It's one of the greatest ironies of religion. Still, for most of us, growing up where we have, religion is about a certain kind of story. It's about finding the right relationship to God, just one, we know his name, we know where he came from, that God. And not to care about that in Western religion is seen as just not caring about life or seriousness or truth or ethics or love. And there's a lot at stake, of course, in Western religion because this God holds the key to eternal punishments or rewards. you're spanked or rewarded for obeying not what the God has told you, but what the priests have told you. And there it gets messy. Still, it's what religion has been for almost everyone in the West. I want to take you to a very different world today, to a very different story. It's one older than any religion in the world and older than all the gods in the world. Long before the Hebrews, long before the Greeks, 1,500 years before the Hindus, there was an earlier high civilization in Sumer with a very different kind of story about gods, humans, life, and immortality. It's the Epic of Gilgamesh. It was only unearthed and translated in the 19th and 20th centuries, and I think most people still don't know a lot about it. I don't think you can overstate just how deeply different and disturbing it is to all Western religious thought. First, it disturbed Western thinkers when these things were being translated 130 years ago, because it contains the ancient story of a flood and a couple who were warned about the flood by their god and told to build an ark to survive it. This angered a lot of Western thinkers because this was obviously the story of Noah told well over 1,000 years before the Bible version could have been written down. Now it's generally accepted by biblical scholars as the source of the Noah flood. That was the 1870s. By the 1890s, some scholars were making much bolder claims, the kind that could get you burned at the stake in less enlightened times, if we've had those. And what the scholars were saying in the 1890s was that not only is this myth older than the Bible, it's better than the Bible. And the reason they said it's better than the Bible is because this is a myth for people living in modern times. It's a myth to which we can relate more easily and natural than the myths of the Bible. Now, that's quite a claim for a story that goes back over 4 millennia, that it's the most modern. And yet, ironically, even the Gilgamesh story seems to be making this claim, that their modern world is just no longer served by the ancient world of its superstitions and its gods and its stories of immortality. Why would they think they're so modern? Gilgamesh was a historical figure. He lived, he ruled in the city of Uruk, in what is now southern Iraq. 4,600 years ago, he ruled. Why on earth would he think he was modern? Because he lived during the first century or two after the Sumerians had, for the first time that we know of, invented writing. The first people in history who had history, the first people in history who could write and transmit to others their wisdom. Can you imagine how primitive and ignorant everyone before them must have looked to them? What an amazing achievement. This is when the story was written. No wonder they thought they were modern. You could say that Gilgamesh was an ancient Sumerian. He knew he was a Sumerian. He did not know that he was ancient. He was quite clear that he was modern. And the outlook on life that he develops and that comes through this story is an outlook specifically developed for people living in modern times. This makes it one of the most ironic of all religious stories because it's also the oldest that we have. We have thousands of fragments of this myth, and altogether we have about 3,000 lines of the story, which went through 1,000 years of being told after Gilgamesh ruled 4,600 years ago. During the century after his life, the legends of his life were turned into mythic fragments. And these were written into poems, a big selection of poems. And those poems were kept and loved and circulated for 1,000 years. This is a time scale that's almost impossible for us to relate to. That's older than Austin. 1,000 years the poem circulated. And then they were combined into the Epic of Gilgamesh that finally took its final form somewhere around 3,300 years ago. Old stuff. The two main characters in the story are fascinating. And this is where ancient mythology and absolutely modern psychology blend together to the point that it's hard to tell which is which. Gilgamesh is described as two-thirds divine and one-third human. So he's up at this end. We have a spectrum here. And now, he was not a well-loved king. He built that big wall that they talked about in the story. That's what he's known for, building a wall to protect his city. And the gods, they say, Shamash, the sun god, since Gilgamesh was such an arrogant king, built an anti-hero to confront him. Fascinating. What he built was Gilgamesh's complement, Gilgamesh's opposite. And that's Enkidu. The story also has some of the greatest names for character. You've got Enkidinkidu, and the great evil creature that they destroy is Humbaba. You can hardly find stories with better names than Enkidu and Humbaba. So Enkidu is about one-third human and two-thirds beast. And he's Gilgamesh's other half, and they create him to confront or control Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh gets word of this, but he's no fool. Now, in the children's story, that was the G-rated version of the woman that was sent out to Enkidu. In the ancient versions, it's probably a temple prostitute. But Gilgamesh sends her out to tame Enkidu. What a fascinating idea. She seduces him. He spends a week with her. And at the end of a week, he becomes civilized, human, and urban. I know women who said if this could be done in a year, it'd be a miracle. I don't hear many men say that. But so once Enkidu becomes more human, he challenges Gilgamesh to a fight. Gilgamesh challenges him, but he certainly has no fear. And the two fight, but it's a draw. Well, of course it's a draw. They're each other's complements. They're created as each other's complements. You have the sun side and the shadow side for this. It's fascinating. And after they fight to a draw, they become the closest of friends. They integrate all of the parts of humanity. It's what the story's saying. In other words, the story's saying, put these two guys together and you have what a human is. We're about a third beast. Some more, some less. We're about a third human. And we're about a third divine. And the challenge is, how do you put these together to describe a realistic picture of a modern human life? Remember, this story wants us to be modern. That's at the same time better than any of the alternative stories that we've been told. That's the challenge of this story. You'll decide for yourself whether it meets it. I think it does, and I think it's one of the most stunning stories in all of religious history. Now, once they're together, they're immensely powerful, and they fear absolutely nothing. They don't fear the gods either. And you don't find this very often in religious stories. So the gods send Humbaba, what a wonderful word, who is a horribly evil monster, actually. It's a incarnation of evil in the form of this awful monster. They're not the least bit frightened. They take him on and they kill him. I mean, see where this is going for a religious story. This is really quite something. Now, Ishtar, the great goddess Ishtar, who fancies herself as being the goddess of love and peace, though that's not the way history records it, Ishtar approaches Gilgamesh and she proposes to him. She wants him to marry her. Okay, this isn't a bad offer. You've been given a chance to marry an immortal goddess. Now, you're not being offered immortality, just the chance to marry an immortal goddess. So the offer gets a little less exciting when you do that. Gilgamesh says, why? He said, why should I care? What have you got that I need? I mean, imagine this. This isn't your normal conversation with powerful deities in world literature. And she said, I can offer you love and peace. And I'm sure she says it with all the authority of a big goddess. And Gilgamesh says, nonsense. Your love leads to war. And then he tells her all the stories of all the other lovers that she's betrayed. He said, you can't be trusted. Your love can't be trusted. It leads to war. Who needs it? No thanks. Well, this makes her, hell hath no fury like a goddess scorned. Now she's really furious, and now she really doesn't care whether he lives or dies, although she has a strong preference. And so Ishtar sends the bull of heaven, terrifying, huge creature, sort of incorporating the supernatural power of the heaven. She sends the bull of heaven against both Gilgamesh and Enkidu to kill them both. They kill it. Imagine this. Enkidu plunges a sword into it. They kill it. They tear out its heart. And they offer the heart to Shamash, the sun god. But this is more of sort of a perfunctory bribe. There's no notion anywhere in the story that either of them cares a thing about Shamash or any of the gods. If they're going to be hanging around, if it pays to offer them perfunctory bribes, do it. In the meantime, these two men, or one man, joined fully together, have the power to defeat most of the gods and most of what the gods send to them. How many religious stories have you read like this? It makes it very hard for a story like this to empower a priest. It's like you'd be putting on the wrong kind of costume if you want to tell this story and then play a priest. This is part of why it's such a stunning story. Well, Enkidu does die. He suffered wounds in the fight with Humbaba. And there's some notion that somebody needs to die for killing the bull of heaven, because that was really a favorite pet of the gods. And Enkidu dies. This is where the story now takes a big turn. Because Gilgamesh, though he's a king, has never experienced death. He's had the closest friendship in his life. It's the fullest he has ever been or possibly ever could be as a person. And it's not eternal. His friend dies. Now Gilgamesh wanders around wondering if there's a way to beat this dying stuff. And he wonders if the gods could be useful. I mean, it's the sort of thing gods are supposed to be useful for, he thinks. But he's not finding that the gods can do anything about this. Then he hears a story from ancient times. Remember, he's a modern man. He hears a story from ancient times about that flood and the time that the gods found that old Noah figure who had a different, longer name, Utnapishtim. And that the gods had warned Utnapishtim and his wife about the flood, and they'd built an ark, and since they'd been able to stay awake for the whole 7 days of the flood, then the gods made them immortal. So I thought, all right, it happened. I'll find out the secret to this, and I want to go do that. So he travels, and he finds the old Noah figure, who actually is not a very happy man, and this is a shock, too. If you've got immortality, why aren't you happy? Well, because everyone else you know is dead. His son is dead, and he has grieved his son ever since his death. And this sobers Gilgamesh up and says, immortality doesn't even look like a wise route for people. Still, I want to know if there's a way to do this. And old Noah says, no. He said it only happened once. This was a one-time deal. The gods made us immortal for escaping in the flood, and so we could escape in the flood and could stay awake for 7 days. It's never going to happen again. The gods are useless for this. So the gods now have been dismissed in this story. It's really pretty stunning. But the quest for immortality hasn't, and now it actually sounds more modern. Because once Gilgamesh decides the gods are useless, he says, all right, I'll take a pill. There's got to be some medical folks around here. I can get, somebody can mix me some stuff together. I'll eat it. I don't need the gods. It can let me live forever because pills and nature have all the power the gods do without bothering with the gods. And old Noah says, yeah, all right, there is a pill. There is a pill. They didn't call it a pill. Said it's a plant. It's a plant called the old become young again. And Gilgamesh is thinking, okay, that's a good one. And he said, it grows at the bottom of the sea, but if you get the plant and you eat the plant, you can live forever. And he didn't add the small print, which is that this too will only work once. So Gilgamesh goes out, and by golly, he finds the plant. And he puts it in his boat. However, the plant slips out of the boat, and you guessed it, a snake ate it. And that's why snakes can renew their skin and become young again, and people can't. Now, since we live in a different kind of modern time, where we don't have the first kind of naivete that ancients could bring to myths, we might not understand this story. And you might ask, well, what would have happened if Gilgamesh had eaten the plant? Well, I'll tell you what. Then he would have had to find either that the plant didn't work or that he did something wrong and he's never going to have another chance. Because the story was written by people who know we're not immortal and we can't be. And they wrote an imaginative story to give form to this. That's the order these things came in. It didn't come in the other order. Well, now Gilgamesh has explored everything he can, and he's realized the gods are useless. The plants were pretty good, but there was only one shot at that too, and the damn snake got it. So this is it. To be human is to live and to die. Now he has a conversion experience. He switches to a different center than the one he's been chasing for the whole story, which is to find either the cure or the pill. Now he's switching centers. Here was his spiritual journey. First, he seeks the cure for the fact that we must die, and he assumes this is what the gods can do. But he finds that in modern times, the gods are useless for this. Oh yeah, there's a story about way back in mythic times, they did it once, only once, but it isn't ever going to happen again. This isn't useful. Besides that, the one guy he met who is immortal is a miserable man. He misses everybody he knows who died. What kind of heaven is this? Then he goes to the pill. I'll take the pill, that'll do it. But then he finds that isn't available in modern times anymore either. It only worked once and the snake got it. Finally, he understands that neither gods nor natural roots can lead us beyond the fact that we're born, we live, and we die, and become part of the world. And this is one of the most powerful phrases in this whole story. I've never seen it written quite this way. We become a part of the world of the irretrievably dead. What a statement. Even kings die, and he was a king. Even the rich die. Even the pretty die. Even the talented. Even us. So, what does the human condition offer? This is the last half of the story. What is a reality-based solution to this human longing? Many things. Once Gilgamesh has been converted, he suddenly looks at the whole world around him in a different way. He's suddenly noticing things he'd never noticed before. And the riches that he notices fill the rest of the story. He notices the city that he's returning to and how beautiful it is, and that we built it and he built the walls. This is pretty spectacular. He hears people laughing. He hears people having parties and celebrating. Joy is part of what the world offers. Friendship, he already knew. His friendship with Enkidu transformed his life. Love, sex, relationships, families, children who survive us. This is the kind of human immortality that he's finding on a very different scale, a human-sized scale, instead of this ancient mythic-sized scale that doesn't work anymore in modern times. When our friends die, like Enkidu, we can memorialize them. We can write poems about them. We can build statues to them. We can make sure that they never die the second death in our lifetime. I'll tell you how modern this is. This reminds me of the modern author Borges, who said, and that's a line I use at many memorial services, Borges said, "We all die twice." He said, "The first time is when the body finally gives out. But the second and final death," he said, "comes only when there is no one left to tell our story." Gilgamesh could have written this. He accepts the first death. And then he says, but we can postpone the second death throughout our lifetime and our awareness, through our poems, our memories, our stories, through the things we build, the relationships we have, the love we invest in, the children we love and raise who will grow on past us. We can postpone the second death throughout our lifetimes. And not only is that not bad, it's enough. He didn't want life with the gods. Gods are indifferent to us. Gods have no particular concern with these creatures of a day, with our pains and longings. They live forever. They don't need to be wise. Wisdom isn't something the gods need or have. When you have power and eternity, you don't need to be wise. Animals don't need wisdom either, the beasts. They're living in the moment. That's where they are, and they do it wonderfully. But they don't need a perspective on it. They don't need wisdom. So what Gilgamesh finds is that what's offered to us as humans is absolutely peculiar and precious and unique. We are offered a kind of wisdom, a wisdom of living in a fragile and transient life, a wisdom that is available neither to the beasts nor to the gods, a wisdom that is available only to humans, and the pursuit and achievement of this living fully and wisely and well is the highest thing not only to which we can aspire, but higher than anything to which either the beasts or the gods could aspire. It's not bad. So what's essential about excellence in humanity is precisely our fragility. We who live and die will nevertheless love, make friendships, build cities, find joy, create children, and invest our love and our lives with them. I'm reminded of an old Twilight Zone show some of you may have seen in this. But it's the same kind of passion in here. It was a Twilight Zone about a man who was immortal. And he was about 40 years old always. And he'd been about 40 years old for 3,000 years or so. And you find a photo of him from the Civil War when he looks just like he does now. And during all these lifetimes, he falls in love and marries or has children with lots and lots and lots of wives, who all grow old and die while he stays 40. And at the end of the program, he's finally killed by one of his past wives, who's 85 now, who says she cannot stand the idea of his continuing to break hearts of people who, after all, are not like him at all. That's what this is about. We don't need the love of the gods. They don't get it. They're not like us. We need to come to full humanity. After all, Gilgamesh said, he was a modern man. And as he might have said, nostalgia for the ancient ways no longer serves us. This isn't atheism. This is growing beyond the need for gods. I don't know many stories that do that. And Gilgamesh then might have quoted Howard Thurman, who would say, don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come most fully alive and go do that, because what the world really needs is people who have come most fully alive into their full humanity. And then I think old Gilgamesh might just have said, amen.